our next presenter, his office is just a couple blocks from here, but this topic was recommended by a colleague of mine at a different meeting, and a representative from one of their 33 other offices made a similar presentation, and it's very interesting. So it was very well received at that meeting, and I think it'll be as well here. So Harold's bio is on your program. I'm not going to go through all of it, but he'll cover, he'll introduce and cover what he's going to talk about. Please ask questions. This is a speaker that you'll want to take notes today. So feel free to do that. Feel free to ask questions. And this is Ed.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. As a lifelong New Orleanian, I want to thank you for coming to our city and having your meeting here. I hope you enjoy the wonderful food, culture. Don't drink too much because you won't make it to the meeting tomorrow. If anybody asks you where you got your shoes, they're on your feet on Bourbon Street. There's one about I can tell you who your daddy is, and I don't know the answer to that one, but just walk away. I'm a native New Orleanian. Been here all my life, and about 25 years ago, I started practicing law. And when I started out, I was in a much more traditional New Orleans industry of maritime and oil and gas work, and that lasted for about 2 years. And then, as is going on today, the price of oil fell to record lows, and I had to find a new field of endeavor. So I lucked into employment law, and employment law deals with basically every aspect of the relationship between you and your employees, and sometimes people who are not your employees, whether that's safety and health, benefits, unions, or discrimination laws, Americans with Disabilities Act, FMLA. There are thousands upon thousands of laws around this country that involve you and your employers. I saw that there's some people here from Oregon, and the minimum wage in Seattle in Portland, they're putting in a bunch of new laws, particularly with how you schedule employees. It's basically it only applies to employers with 500 or more employees, and it makes it so difficult to schedule your employees in a retail business that no large company is going to want to do business there. It's basically we want to protect local business law. It really doesn't have much to do with scheduling employees. But those are the types of things we deal with on a daily basis that are out there, and they're happening and they're changing all the time. Right now, because of the basic gridlock that we've had in Washington for many, many years, and I understand the speaker was before me, touched a lot on what's going on in Washington, we haven't had many significant laws passed through Congress. The only one that really affects employers, it's been the last 16 years, is the Affordable Care Act. And now that is a massive piece of legislation. I have an associate who does nothing but work with employers on the Affordable Care Act. It's so big. So, you know, I guess that's good for me. It's not good for my insurance premiums, though, which have gone through the roof. But what's going on is, since Congress is not doing anything and the president can't get his agenda through that way, all the activity in our field is being driven by federal agencies. And this includes the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the Wage and Hour Division, the National Labor Relations Board, OSHA, all these different federal organizations are out there stretching the law. They are taking the agenda that has not been successful in getting through your legislative process and trying to enact that agenda through regulation and regulatory reform at the agencies. Some of these have worked. Some of these have gotten through. Some of these have been held up by the courts. But that is where the action is. It is within the agencies. And so it is more important than ever. 15 years ago, if you got an EEOC charge, it wasn't that big of a deal. And certainly if you got an EEOC charge that said I was being discriminated against on account of my sexual orientation, it was no deal at all because sexual orientation was not covered under Title VII. And there's 50 years of case law on that. And the EEOC recently, within the last 2 years, has sort of started flipping its position on that and is now contending and filing lawsuits all over the country that say sex in Title VII that says thou shalt not discriminate on account of race, sex, national origin, religion, that term sex includes sexual orientation. And so now if you get a charge of discrimination, unlike the old ones that would say because I'm a woman, because I'm a certain religion, because I'm African American, or this, that, or the other thing, the old ones, now it says because of my sexual orientation. And that is, and if you get one of those, you are much more likely to get sued by the EEOC than you ever have been before. Because they are taking this agenda, and they want to protect people on account of sexual orientation and feel that's one of their policy goals. And they are being very aggressive about bringing that forward and suing people over it. We are defending EEOC cases around the country that deal with sexual orientation discrimination. So that's an example of how the world is, how our world is changing today. I mean, and that is a hot topic. I didn't include it in the slides, but you do have to be much more wary these days of somebody making a claim of discrimination on account of sexual orientation. What I'm going to touch on today are some of the areas that have gotten employers in the most trouble over the past few years. And it's going to start with wage and hour and then talk about problem employees. But the first few slides deal with wage and hour because this is the most the most complex law I think there is, and it applies to the most employers. If you are a small employer and you have fewer than 15 employees, you are not covered by Title VII. If you have fewer than 50 employees, you are not covered by the Family and Medical Leave Act. The Fair Labor Standards Act works differently. It's based on having $500,000 a year in revenues, or having even if you're not covered because you don't have $500,000 in revenue, an employee can be covered because they're engaged in interstate commerce, which means they pick up the phone and make a long distance call. So the Fair Labor Standards Act is a pervasive law that covers virtually every employee in the country in every position and has numerous little intricacies that are far beyond what I can talk about today. But it is very, very easy to get them wrong. Now, this is the number one most common mistake under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that is, as long as I pay my employees a salary, I don't have to pay them overtime. Now, it is true that if you want to not pay your employees overtime, that you must pay them on a salary basis. But the fact that you pay your employees a salary does not mean that you don't have to pay overtime. You see, the Fair Labor Standards Act starts out with a very simple rule. You must pay all your employees the minimum wage plus time and a half at their regular rate of pay for every hour worked over 40 in a work week. So it sets out the minimum wage and the overtime. Now, if you don't want to pay somebody overtime, they have to fall within what is known as an exemption to that rule. So the baseline is every employee must be paid on an hourly basis and must be paid overtime. And then you, the employer, have to prove that there's an exemption. Now, this is going on all over the place. There are, if you drive over on the Gulf Coast, you will see law firms. We used to see somebody who's talking about seeing a bunch of personal injury attorney advertisements out there. There are billboards now asking people about how they're paid, things like day rates that can be very problematic, per diems. You know, the employees love per diems because you give them a $50 a day per diem. It's not salary. You don't pay taxes on it, they don't pay taxes on it. But if the IRS comes along and says, or the DOL comes along and says it wasn't a per diem, you got a problem. So there are lawyers out there advertising for these things, and the salary basis is the big one. There are very few employees that qualify to be paid on a salary basis. So, and I'll go through some of those exemptions in a second. Backing up, if you're not paying somebody correctly, if you're paying them a salary and they should be paid hourly, and let's face it, the reason we're paying them a salary is so we don't have to pay them overtime, right? I work my associates 60, 70 hours a week at least. You know, if I don't see them there on Sunday night, I get upset, right? I mean, they're young kids. They should be working. They're millennials. They're never there. I don't know how they get their work done. But the regular rate of pay is what you pay somebody regularly for an hourly rate. So if you're paying somebody $10 an hour, overtime's $15 an hour. That's an easy formula. If you pay somebody a salary, and this is how easy this mistake can be made. Let's say you're paying $10 an hour, and you know they work 84 hours a week. And this is a true story, happened after Katrina, where labor was in short supply and security guards were working 84 hours a week. And somebody had the bright idea to say, well, we're paying them $10 an hour for 40 hours, and we're paying them $15 an hour for 44 hours every week. So I'm just going to figure out what that, I can't remember what the number was, $1,800 a week or something like that. I'm just going to turn that into a salary and just, you know, pay them the salary and for their 84 hours a week. And it was a paper issue. These people got every penny that they were owed. But because you can't pay a security guard a salary, because they don't fall into one of these exemptions I'll talk about in a second, the DOL came in and said, no, you paid them a salary, it covered the minimum wage, but I'm going to divide 84 hours into the salary, and that's going to be the regular rate of pay. And so that came out to somewhere around the $12.50, something like that. Okay. So their regular rate's $12.50. Now you owe them the halftime on top of that for the 44 hours they worked each week. So that's $6.25 per halftime hour. I mean, per hour overtime. It's you pay the halftime, not the thing. So that came out to, you know, it sounds easy, right? That's okay, that's only $270 a week. But it's $270 a week for 2 years, could be three, $270 a week for 2 years for each employee. And the liability was $300,000 or $400,000. All because somebody said, hey, we're working them 84 hours every week. We're paying them $10 an hour plus $15 an hour. So I'm just going to write it down as a salary so I don't have to do all this bookkeeping. Okay? That's how you get in trouble with this issue. So you have to know if you're paying somebody whether or not they are actually paid a salary. Now, what is a salary? A salary is an amount that you pay an employee on a per week basis that doesn't change based on the quantity or quality of work performed. So I may expect my associates to work 60 hours. 1 week they only work 40 hours. Their salary doesn't move. Their salary doesn't change. If you're dipping into people's salary or you're adjusting it on a weekly basis, that's not good. That will mean you're not paying them on a salary basis. It's a very, very simple thing. They get the same amount every week. Just as an aside, if you ever do an offer letter, always express your salary on a weekly basis, what the salary is per week, not per year, not per annual, because the way the act is broken down, it's a per week basis, and it's a lot easier when I'm defending a lawsuit to have that per week sitting there on a piece of paper. Or you can say $52,000 annually, which is $1,000 a week, either way. But it is an amount per week. Okay. Now, if the amount also has to be a certain level, that was $455 a week, was the minimum salary you could pay to have somebody be a salaried employee and not owe them overtime. That is changing. And this is, again, what I'm talking about, this administrative agency. On December 1st, the minimum salary to have a salaried exempt employee who you do not have to pay overtime to is $913 a week. I think it's $47,900 a year. So you may have somebody back in your accounting department who's, and I'll talk about the exemptions in a second, but let's assume they're exempt, and they're making $40,000 a year salary. And that's fine right now. But if you don't want to give them a $7,900 raise on December 1st, you're going to have to do something different. And that's start paying them on an hourly basis. Now, what was the purpose of this? See, people in Washington, and particularly in the wage and hour division, believe that employers are evil. We are. We're evil. You know, we take advantage of every employee ever. I mean, that is the mindset that you deal with. And so their whole thought is that every salaried employee is being paid $455 a week and working 80 hours a week. Now, there are a lot of salaried employees I know who think they work 80 hours a week. And if you actually had a time clock, you would see they work 35. But they will tell you they work 80. But in the retail industry is where this really got its sort of, not in your industry, but in retail, you have these store managers who are paid a salary because they manage the store. I'll talk about that exemption in a second. And they are making $35,000 or $40,000 a year. These are not big stores. This is a little store you see in any mall in America, a Foot Locker, or any of those stores. You know, it's a $35,000 to $40,000 a year job to manage one of those stores. And a lot of times, those managers tend to work long hours. Now, having worked in the retail industry for the past 20 years with a lot of retail clients, generally, the ones that work 60 hours shouldn't really be managing the store in the first place. They're working 60 hours because they're not good at what they do. And there are lots of other managers who are working 45. So it was believed that these people shouldn't be paid a salary, that you're taking advantage of them by working them 60 hours a week. And so they increase this. And the purpose is to try and get those people into an hourly wage and overtime position. That's where this is coming from. So if you have somebody who's making $40,000 a year as an accountant in your department, you're going to have to figure out whether you're going to give them a raise or whether you're going to start paying them hourly and overtime. Now, you can figure it out that this person ordinarily works 45 hours a week and pay them so they end up with the exact same amount of money based on a 40-hour of regular time and 5 hours of overtime. But what happens when they miss a few hours in a couple of weeks? They don't make it all anymore. Now they lose that 5 or 6 hours because they ran out of PTO, but they had a kid's thing that was really important, and you said, fine, take the time off, it's unpaid. But now they lost money that week, when if they were a salaried employee, they wouldn't have lost that money. So not every employee is happy about this either. And a lot of people think it's really insulting to have to punch a time clock after you haven't had to do it for 10 years. But this is what the government's doing. It's saying, we're going to protect these workers. Now, the second part, and this is the part that everybody messes up, is the salary is half of it. All paying that salary is half of the equation. In order for somebody not to be paid overtime, they have to have certain specific duties. And there are several different tests. An executive is a person who manages at least 2 full-time employees. Now, it can be 4 half-times. It's got to equal 2 full-time employees. They have to manage them. And their decisions about, or their recommendations on hiring and firing, carry a particular weight. So if you've got somebody that's in charge of a division that's got 30 employees under them, and he's doing the hiring and firing, you're fine. The recent one I had was the head of groundskeeping at an apartment complex, but they only had 1.5 employees under him. And so even though he hired and fired and set the schedules and supervised and did all that, because he only had 1.5 employees, he didn't qualify for the exemption. So now they're being sued for not paying him overtime. Okay, so that's your executive managerial exemption. Your professional exemption is an easier one. It's architects, engineers, attorneys. Somebody who has engaged in a specified course of education to obtain a significant professional degree. Professionals also, teachers fall in this one, as do artists, interestingly enough. People who work in a field of artistic endeavor. That's a pretty simple one. Now but those are pretty easy. They're pretty black and white to figure out. You know, do you have two employees? Are you hiring and firing, or at least making recommendations with respect to hiring and firing? Or do you have a degree, or are you a teacher or an artist? So where does everybody stick, everybody that's not one of those two, into this third category? It's called the administrative exemption. And the administrative exemption says you can't be doing manual labor. It's got to be office work, no more than 20% manual labor. It's got to be involved in the general business operations of the employer. And they have to exercise judgment on matters of significance. Independent discretion and judgment on matters of significance. And those are words that cause dollar signs to light up in attorneys' eyes. Because if there's one thing we love, it's words that you really can't define and are totally ambiguous. Because I can fight over the meaning of independent discretion and judgment on matters of significance until the cows come home. I can't fight this case. They only had 1.5 employees. I can't fight that. Independent discretion and judgment on matters of significance, I can fight all day long. But because of that, this is the one that gets the most scrutiny. And this is the one where if somebody finds out they're being paid a salary and they're going to ask them about what they do, and they're going to say, well, I'm the executive assistant for the CEO. Well, an executive assistant for the CEO can be a very important person who makes a lot of decisions on a daily basis about who gets in, who gets out, what he does, where he goes, and most importantly, puts him or her in touch with their spouse when their spouse calls. But an executive assistant to a CEO can also be somebody that basically has clerical responsibilities. And just because they're working in an office and they're working for a high-level person and even getting paid $100,000 a year doesn't mean that they're exempt from the minimum wage and overtime requirements of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Now, you have to be very careful with this administrative exemption, and it works on an individual basis, not position by position, employee by employee. Because you can have two people in the same position, and the example I always use is you have a collections person who's been with you for 20 years, and he or she doesn't ever talk to you about collections except to tell you what money came in. Because they know the customers, they know who they can extend credit to, they know who to push on to get paid, they know who to lay off of for a couple of weeks. They're your collections department, and they're making significant calls. But the guy you hired 6 months ago who doesn't know your customers, who doesn't know who needs to be leaned on or who needs to be given a little leniency, is going to be asking you, should I call so-and-so and lay the hammer down and say, get us that $10,000. So even though they're both in the collections department, one of them is probably an administrative exempt employee and the other one is not because of how they perform their job. This is where most of the litigation is because it is such a nebulous area. So it's your paying your secretary a salary and thinking you don't have to pay her overtime. And I think the reason this whole concept of salary is so prevalent is the way I see businesses growing, at least within law firms. Generally what happens is somebody's sitting around in the business and they look around and they think, boy, I could do this a lot better than the owner, and so I'm going to go out and start my own business. And all I know is, well, I don't want to pay anybody overtime because I'm poor and I'm just starting my own business, so I'm going to pay everybody a salary so I don't have to pay them overtime. And that gets ingrained in the culture of a company, and all of a sudden, you know, person's successful and they have 200 employees and they don't have a single hourly employee in the place. And this happens. That's sort of where this is all coming from. There is an exception for computer employees, but these are not your help desk people. These are programmers. It is a very stringent test. There's also this sort of highly paid employee exemption that was only created not 7 years ago. And that was somebody doing office work that you are paying them a minimum of $100,000 a year. So, and they didn't have to exercise discretion and judgment, but they had to be working on important. I can't remember the exact language of that one. I haven't seen anybody really using this one. But the main thing was that you had to pay them $100,000 a year. It's going up along with the salary basis. Now, to use that exemption, you're going to have to be paying them $134,000 a year. I have yet to meet any employee in any occupation that was earning $134,000 a year that wasn't really in one of these other categories. So it's just not it's not being used very much. This will be indexed for inflation. The amounts will go up every 3 years. So this is, and it will be effective on December 1st. So what you really need to know, what's the takeaway from all this with what's coming along? You need to understand who your salaried employees are, whether or not they are actually exempt correctly, and figure out how this is going to affect you money-wise. Certainly, you can change anybody that's under the 49 threshold to hourly plus overtime. It is amazing how many extra hours it takes somebody to get a job done when they get overtime. I've always been astounded by that. I was working with a little refrigeration company that had these managers that only had one employee apiece, so we had to try and shove them into the administrative exemption. And the reason we were doing that was they were lollygagging and booking 42 or 43 hours a week. We had them hourly. So we changed them and made them salaried, and all of a sudden, you could tell by when they opened when they swiped to get in the store and when they left that they were working 37 and a half hours a week, and that was it once we put them on salary. That extra 5 hours went away. But you have to figure out, how am I going to pay people, and what do I do in monetarily? What's going to happen to my business? This is also a great opportunity to fix mistakes. The way the wage and hours laws work is I'm incorrectly paying somebody a salary, and I should have been paying them overtime. And I've got 2 years of liability hanging on for that person. When I switch them to hourly and start paying them overtime and paying them correctly, every day, part of that 2 years of liability disappears. So, once you change somebody and start doing it correctly, your liability starts going away. The hardest part of this process when I'm working with companies to correct their past mistakes is to explain to the employees why it's happening without sending them into the arms of a lawyer who is then going to sue you for those 2 years of salary. And by the way, you can't terminate an employee because they sue you under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's illegal too, so just be aware. As much as you'd like to, I know, this is a great opportunity. Why are you doing this? Because the government's making me. They think you should punch a clock. Even if you were doing it wrong, it's all over the news. The way this is, you've seen the headlines, but the headlines say 4 million people to be eligible for overtime. For 4 million employees now to be eligible for overtime. That's what's out there in USA Today and all the different magazines and things like that that are talking about this. But if you've got somebody incorrectly classified as exempt and you are paying them a salary and that is wrong, now is the time because you have the excuse for making the change. So that's something to take away. A couple of other things that these go back, going back into your hourly employees, where you do have hourly employees. We talked about that concept of regular rate of pay. Okay, so if I pay you $10 an hour, and that's all the money you earn from me is $10 an hour, that's your regular rate of pay. So overtime is $15 an hour. That's an easy one. But what sometimes people don't understand is there are a lot of other payments that you make to employees that must be included in that regular rate of pay. So if I'm paying you a base of $10 an hour and you get some kind of bonus based on productivity or incentive pay or other things, that is part of the regular rate of pay. And if you go and talk to your payroll people about it, if you have payroll people and aren't using one of these big firms, they will slam the door in your face and start screaming and hiding under their desk. Because it's all, you pay out a bonus quarterly for production. Now, you have to go back and recalculate overtime for all those employees based on including that quarterly bonus in a regular rate of pay. And a lot of people don't do that. And now, it's usually only, it's not a whole lot of money, because usually most people make most of their money on the hourly, and these incentives might be a dollar an hour or something like that. So it might only add 50 cents an hour to the overtime hours that they worked over that quarter, and it might be $20. But if you don't do this, and if you have a lot of employees, then these small amounts can add up over time. Now, this does not include, you know, they don't look at the value of the Christmas turkey. That's not going to be included. If you just give your employees a bonus at Christmas, a discretionary bonus that they didn't have any right to, that's not included. But if they have any way where it says you earn X by doing Y, and they're hourly employees, that's included in the regular rate of pay. And that's the biggest mistake being made out there right now with hourly employees. Okay. This is another component of the Fair Labor Standards Act, and we're back to hourly employees. The other great thing about salaried employees is you don't have to keep track of their hours. You don't punch a time clock when you're salaried. Now, you may want to, because some salaried employees try and take advantage of that, but you don't have any record-keeping obligation for a truly exempt employee. You don't have to know when they were at work or what they were doing, etc. Hourly employees, it is the exact opposite. You have to know and keep a record of every time the employee is working. Now, through the late 90s, the law firm where I was, before we merged into the bigger national firm, we were a pretty small shop, and we used timesheets where the secretary would write in, the paralegal would write in the time they came in, the time they went to lunch, the time they left, the time, you know, the time they came back from lunch, and the time they left on a daily basis. And I used to watch my secretary every 2 weeks pull out a blank timesheet and write in 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12. That's not necessarily a good system. You have to understand, you have to make sure that the employee's timekeeping is accurate. There are thousands of systems out there. We use a computer terminal system where employees clock in on the computer. Some people use time clocks. And it is perfectly legal to have somebody write their hours on the back of a cocktail napkin and stick it in a manila folder, if it's accurate. Okay, there's no, you have to do it this way. Now, everybody's going to these biometric scanners and thumbprints and this, that, and the other thing for a variety of reasons that are more security than timekeeping, but there are a thousand ways out there. So what happens, though, in the real world is you think you've got this great system in place, And your secretary, who's the best employee you ever had, realizes she didn't get quite through what you needed done, and so she goes and she punches out, because you know she knows overtime is forbidden. So she goes and punches out and spends 3 hours working off the clock. I've always said this is the only law where your good employees get you in trouble. But if you suffer or permit somebody to work, and if you know or have reason to know that they are working off the clock, you owe them the time, even though they're the one who violated the rule and went and worked off the clock. And this is a very significant thing. It's also significant if you have anybody has access to employees' hours and can edit those hours that they are punching in and punching out, you got to be really careful. We see tons of lawsuits where a supervisor realizes that he's about to get dinged because his labor cost was too high because too many people worked overtime that week. And so what does he do? He goes into the system and shaves off hours from the employees. It happens all the time. You can have big flashing red signs that say, don't ever let anybody tell you to work off the clock. And you can have big red flashing signs that say, if you muck with an employee's time in any way, shape, or form, you will be fired. And it's still going to happen. Because labor costs are what? Most businesses, 30%. It's a big chunk of it. And when you start adding overtime, budgets get blown. And who starts having overtime in his department? The manager who's struggling. And when he's struggling and he's scared and he thinks he's going to lose his job and he's just blown his budget, he's going to go take an hour away from every employee and improve his labor cost by 20 hours that week. There is another concept here. You also have to understand what is and what is not working time. For example, you may pay people for vacation or holidays. Well, that doesn't count toward their 40 hours, and it doesn't count toward overtime because they didn't spend it working. But there are other issues that arise. For example, when you have employees on call, how you develop those policies for people to be on call can turn what should be hours that you don't have to pay them for, even though they're on call, into hours that you have to pay them for. There are very confusing rules around hourly employees and traveling on business. If you send hourly employees to training, I have to look up those rules every single time I get that question. You know, what do I have to pay when my hourly employee is driving to training in Alexandria from here, which is 3 hours? So you have to understand the concept of when are they working and when are they not working. And finally, this is one. At our firm, no hourly employee has access to our email system or our servers from a cell phone or a home computer or a tablet. Because again, it goes back to good employees that want to check their email on the weekends. If your hourly employees are checking emails and responding to emails on the weekend, even though they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart, they're entitled to be paid for those hours that they are doing it. And because it's happening on your server, you know about it, whether you knew it or not. See, we don't allow any of our hourly employees access to any system outside of the office, because we don't want them working. And I will tell you, you know, I love my secretary, and she'd do anything for me, and that's what scares me, because she would take work home and do it off the clock, and I don't want her doing that. So make sure you're keeping track of time. Now, This third one is sort of tangential to the discussion of wages and hours and employees, because, you know, that lawyer was so damn confusing, I have no idea what I'm going to do. But I heard if I just make everybody an independent contractor, I don't have to worry about any of this. 1099 them all. Here we go. I don't care. I mean, this first one is the most important. Is what you have written down on a piece of paper about somebody being an independent contractor does not matter. Period. So let's talk about who is an independent contractor and who is not. Now I'll go back to Microsoft. See, Microsoft had one set of employees who would come into work every day, and they had a blue badge, and they would come and they would sit down at their computers and they would program all day long. And they had another set of employees who had a red badge, and they would come and sit down at their computers and program all day long. Now, the blues were paid as employees and got W-2s. The reds were paid on a 1099. Now, they had all the reds go out and set up their own little company so that they weren't writing out the payments to the individuals. They were writing it out to the individual's company. And they had all these agreements about you must have workers' comp insurance and this, that, and the other thing. But it didn't work. And in that case, the issue wasn't overtime or minimum wage, because these were highly paid people and they were paid under their independent contractor relationship time and a half for over 40. So they got paid all their wages. What they didn't like and they sued over was that they weren't covered by the benefit plans. I don't have health insurance, and I got $1 million in hospital bills. Boy, who can pay that $1 million in hospital bills for me? Microsoft can. So that, and Microsoft was the big case back in the 90s that kind of set all this thing off. What is a true independent contractor? It is not somebody sitting there doing the exact same work as your employee in your business. In other words, if I operate a gas station and I hire people to pump gas, and I'm old enough to remember this, full serve. There's some state where it's mandatory that it's full serve. I really like that idea. Is it New Jersey? Oregon too. I love that. I wish they'd bring that back. You know, now I do actually have a full serve station in my neighborhood, and I feel a little dirty when I get them to pump their my gas for me, but it's nice. But if I'm hiring people to pump my gas, they're not independent contractors. They're performing an important function of my operations. They're doing what I'm in business to do. Okay? Now, on the other hand, if I hire Joe to come paint my gas station, I'm not in the painting business. I'm not supplying the paint. I'm not supplying the tools, the paintbrushes. He tells me I'm going to paint it for $3,000. I'm not paying him by the hour, because Lord knows who wants to pay a real independent contractor by the hour. Boy, that job would take a long time. So that sort of, and this goes back, this is not my example, it's my law school professor's example. There are, now, if you actually start Googling independent contractor versus employee, what you're going to find is the IRS has a 20-factor test, and the Department of Labor has a 7-factor test, and another agency will have a 12-factor test. And trying to get into all those tests and figure out what's going on is not fun, even for people that are getting paid a lot to do it. All right. So I really think this is one you can gut. If you got an individual who's coming to your place of business every day and working for you every day and it working anywhere else. I don't care what he's, and he's not employed by another company. If you're dealing with that individual directly, they're not an independent contractor. And so my example doesn't work if you hire somebody to be a janitor and he's coming in every day, because that's not a project. That's not a something that I've just hired this guy to do for me and then be gone and done. That person doesn't have their own sort of business and incentives. There are problems. The penalties up here are actually the California penalties. These are not in every state, but these are the most severe penalties. Now, Louisiana had a bill on the table for a $10,000 per misclassification penalty for this last year, and this sort of thing is sweeping through state legislatures. And why is it sweeping through state legislatures? States are broke. What happens when you pay somebody as an independent contractor? You don't pay Social Security. You don't pay unemployment. You don't pay some of these other Medicare, Medicaid. Now, for the federal government, they're not as worried about this, because if you issued that guy a 1099, they're getting the self-employment tax anyway. But the states, it's costing them money. So they're going after this in a big way. The sort of derivative of this is that you can have this situation even where you put another company between you and that individual. There are very many laws. Title VII, the National Labor Relations Act, wage and hour, where an individual, for purposes of that law, can have more than one employer. So I hire a subcontractor to help me on a job because I don't have enough people to perform whatever part of the construction or whatever it is. So I know that Joe's got really good carpenters. I need some extra carpenters. I got a really big job that I don't have enough carpenters for. I call Joe's carpenter company and I say, Joe, hey, I want to subcontract you on this job because I need your people. And Joe says, that's great. And you and Joe sit down and negotiate a contract, and you're not paying his people. You came up with a one rate for the whole thing. He's gonna do his part for $100,000. And his people come out and do their part, but they're working alongside your people, and some of your supervisors are over there telling them, hey, you know, you need to do it this way, or you need to do it that way, or you need to do it the other way. Even though you've got that other entity in there, you can be considered their employer too. Now, we all have indemnity agreements with our subcontractors, right? If their employees sue us, it ought to say in our agreement that they're going to defend us, and they're going to pay any liability, and they're going to pay our attorney's fees. So we really shouldn't have to worry about whether or not Joe's paying his carpenters correctly. But you see, what you didn't know was Joe is a drug addict. And when you paid Joe that $100,000, he went to Vegas on a bender. And that job got done in 2 weeks, and all of Joe's employees showed up with their handout, and Joe's rotting in a jail cell. Now, in the category of truth is stranger than fiction, this is a true story. So who do you think the employees are going to look to for payment for the wages that they didn't get? You. Of course they are. And guess what? As between you and a bunch of individuals who worked on your job that didn't get paid, do you think you're getting any sympathy for hiring a drug addict deadbeat who didn't pay his employees? No. You're going to get popped with that. Now, when this happened, luckily, the contractor company hadn't actually paid Joe. He just went on a bender on his own. And he didn't go to Vegas. It was down in Plaquemines Parish, where benders are a lot cheaper. But we had to pay. I mean, luckily, they had held back that money and were able to pay all the employees. there are penalties associated with this too. If you get sued under the Fair Labor Standards Act and you lose, the other side gets liquidated damages. And what that is it's the amount again. So if you had a $100,000 judgment for back wages, they would get another $100,000 on top of that. And then you get to pay their attorneys. And trust me, when attorneys are looking for the other side to pay, clocks run really fast. I mean, how many of you have attorneys that you pay by the billable hour? Come on. Everybody. You all have attorneys. You know, you don't want to have to pay the other side's attorney by their billable hours. It's the old St. Peter joke at the pearly gates where the lawyer shows up and St. Peter goes, "Welcome to heaven." And the lawyer goes, "I'm 28 years old. Why am I dead already?" And St. Peter looks at his timesheets and says, "Well, according to your timesheets, you're 108 years old. So it was about time." That's what happens when the other side's charging you, not when you're paying the other side's attorney's fees. So these lawsuits, and plus you have to pay your own attorney's fees, and these lawsuits are not fun. So it's very important to understand and make sure in your subcontract agreements that they agree to abide by all the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act with respect to their employees, that they are responsible for it, and that you can audit their compliance with that. Because what happens is, let's say you don't do that, and the state comes in and audits one of your subs, and then the person you're working for finds out about it and says, "Well, wait a minute, that state's auditing your sub, I'm not going to pay you, because the state may want that money." And that happens. If you're a federal contractor, and they find out there's some dispute over wages, government's not giving you your money, even if it's a third subcontractor down. They will hold that money until that is worked out. So that's a very important thing to understand. For my last 10 minutes, I'm going to move off of the wage and hour stuff. I actually gave a three-hour presentation on wage and hour the other day, so this trying to fit it in 50 minutes is a little difficult. There are thousands of questions, but those are the hot-button topics you need to know about. I want to spend 10 minutes on problem employees because I have a presentation called Better Than Advil, Terminating the Problem Employee. We have a saying that 2% of your employees cause 98% of your problems. And what I'm always asking is, well, if 2% of your employees are causing 98% of your problems, why aren't you getting rid of that 2%? I mean, you would think you could replace them, right? But people have personalities, and your supervisors have personalities. And guess what? About 20% of the population is in a personality category that hates even the idea of a confrontation. And some of those people are your supervisors. And the idea of going to an employee and saying, "You screwed up, you're out of here," or even, "You screwed up, you don't shape up, you're out of here," is really hard for them to do. And I find this a lot of times. And so people and these supervisors, they take these employees that are problems, and they try and get rid of them. When a supervisor is suggesting an employee transfer from one department to another, you should carefully scrutinize that, because no supervisor wants to let a good employee go. So if they're all behind this transfer, maybe you shouldn't be keeping that employee. So this whole idea of softballing, of not giving people reasons, of not explaining to them what they're doing wrong, is something that I see time and time again out there in the real world. People don't like telling other people you did a bad job or you need to do something differently. And so they're Well, we're just having a reduction in force. That's my favorite one. You know, the ad for the new employee is out on Monday after you told the former employee that you were having a reduction in force on Friday. And just a tiny bit about discrimination laws. You don't ever have to prove, if you're bringing a discrimination lawsuit, that you were discriminated against on account of your race, gender, religion, etc. All you really have to prove is that the employer lied about the reason you were terminated. So, reduction in force. Well, I didn't want to stop. I wanted them to be able to get unemployment. I didn't want to tell them. I thought it was better. We would have gotten real confrontational if I told them something else. None of those are good reasons. Now, I have situations where people really don't want to fight unemployment. And I'm okay with that if you have a letter that the employee signs that says, I understand I'm being terminated for this reason. However, you know, the employer has agreed to write reduction in force in on my pink slip. I really don't like those letters because if the state ever found them, that'd be problematic. But the state's probably not ever going to find them. But lying about the reasons people are terminated is really the biggest way to get in trouble. And it doesn't come from, it's not motivated by some sort of ill intent. It's motivated, the soft selling is motivated because people don't want to hurt other people. And that's what you have to guard against. If you're the owner of a business or a manager over a lot of other people and a lot of supervisors, is you have to make sure they're holding their employees' toes to the line. Because what normally happens is the supervisor finally gets fed up enough to really want to let somebody go, and you go and look at the annual performance evaluation that supervisor gave that employee 3 weeks ago, and they're outstanding, best employee ever. And now you want to terminate them. And it just so happened that employee had an accident. It wasn't a bad one, but it could have resulted in a workers' compensation claim in between the time he got his review and the time the supervisor wants to fire him. So soft selling these things or lying about the reasons or not addressing issues when they happen, I think comes because people are good people, but it really can hurt you down the line. The other thing here is the complainer. And this is one of those things that really gnaws at me. But the biggest form of employment lawsuit claim today is retaliation. Retaliation for making a sex harassment complaint, retaliation for making a wage complaint, retaliation for engaging in protected concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act, retaliation for making and reporting some environmental violation, retaliation, retaliation, retaliation. Right, that is the number one claim being made these days. But you have to be careful about these people that constantly complain, because if you've ever sat next to your wife's uncle at a football game, particularly an LSU game being coached by Les Miles, and your wife's uncle believes that he knows better than the man being paid $7 million a year to coach this team how the game should go, and you have to sit there for 3 hours and listen to him second guess and whine and moan and complain about every play call except for the one where Leonard Fournette runs for 67 yards, it gets old. It's no fun being around these complainers. It's no fun. It's no fun for your other employees. It creates morale issues about these complainers. So you have to really take these complaints seriously. And then if you got somebody that's just a squeaky wheel and you turn up 3 times in a row that they come to you with complaints that are absolutely baseless, we're probably going to fire them for making baseless complaints. But we have to be careful about how there's a process to go through. You have to document, you have to investigate, you have to get witness statements. Now, I don't ever... Anybody ever says the word discrimination or harassment, make sure you take that complaint seriously. I don't care if it's an ex-employee who doesn't work for you anymore. Sometimes the best complaint you get to find out what's really going wrong are from people that got fired a week ago, because now they're not worried about telling you. So you have to take this complaint seriously. But if you get somebody who's constantly complaining, we're going to do the investigation. We're going to engage in our steps. Now, I'm not saying the person complaining about the brand of coffee you use in the morning, you know, or the fact that in New Orleans you are not allowed to wear a Dallas Cowboys shirt on Saints Friday. You need to treat complaints seriously, but you need to be proactive. And if you've got a problem, get with your lawyer and start getting rid of that person. All right, I got 3 minutes. I think I'm. These are just, you can look at this. I've given the slides here. So, okay. And the final thing is employee handbooks. Employee handbooks right now are under a great deal of attack from the National Labor Relations Board. You see, unions have been on a downtrend in membership for 40 or 50 years, and the National Labor Relations Board doesn't have enough to do with its time. What you may not understand is the National Labor Relations Board has jurisdiction over all employers, not just employers with unions. And so they have come out and said, well, we have to justify our existence so that Congress doesn't cut our budget, and we have to find other things to spend our time on. And where they're going is they're going against private employers. And one of the areas that they're going against are employee handbooks. And there are a lot of little things that we for years and years and years thought were fine in our employee handbooks. Dealing with social media policies, with disgruntled employees, with even in workplace violence policies that they will find are violations of the National Labor Relations Act. Because any employee, regardless of whether they're in a union or not, has the right to engage in concerted protected activity. And because of that, if you do things that, and this is the number one example, if you have a rule that says you may not discuss your pay with other employees, that's illegal. Plain and simple. You can tell your supervisors that they can't discuss their pay with other employees, but you can't tell your hourly employees that. You can't tell any employee who's below a supervisor level that they can't discuss their pay with other employees. And that's probably in your handbook. And those are being looked at. Now, I'm actually not a huge believer in employee handbooks at all. I don't like them. I mean, who reads those things? Really? I mean, I stick a piece of paper in front of you, you write down your name, it says you signed it, so you're stuck with it, but nobody ever reads those things. And I'm not saying that you have to go back and do this huge review of your handbook, but there are a few policies. And if you get on our website, which is FisherPhillips.com, you know, you can search for employee handbooks and you'll find the articles about these things that you might want to look at. But it is out there, and it's something that you can do fairly easily and hopefully avoid the consequences of. So anyway, that is my time. I appreciate your attention today. Again, thank you for coming to our city. We love having groups like this, and enjoy yourselves out there tonight and be safe. Long-haul truck drivers or just regular around-town truck drivers? There is, and this is why the FLSA is so complicated, there is an exemption under the FLSA for, it's called the motor carrier exemption, and it applies to certain employees engaged in, who transport goods in interstate commerce. They don't have to cross state lines, but if what's on their truck are goods that are being transported in interstate commerce, then, and they're driving a particular size truck, that can apply to them. If you got a delivery guy, for example, from Napa Auto Parts that's bringing stuff around town, he's in interstate commerce. If you bake the bread in your shop and you put it on a truck with a guy that's driving the truck across town to the restaurant, and it, you're not transporting goods in interstate commerce, and you're not driving a big enough truck, they're not exempt. Now, the semis, again, they are generally, you know, if they're, there are other ways to pay them that are lawful, the miles and things like that, because it adds up properly to the right amounts. But most of those people fall under that motor carrier exemption in the semis, because they're all big enough. One, you got to be a certain size truck, and 99 times out of 100, almost everything you stick on a truck is been in interstate commerce, except, well, y'all are different because y'all are growing products and delivering them to the golf course across town. So I'm not sure that exemption would apply. Truck drivers are used to being paid a certain way. Right.
So basically, they get a certain amount to go from here to here.
Well, is it their truck or is it your truck?
Mine.
It's your truck, and you're paying by the load. I'd have to look at that because there's so many little – the motor carrier one's the one I'm most familiar with. There are a ton of tiny exemptions. If you work on one of those, everybody knows Deadliest Catch, there are exemptions in the Fair Labor Standards Act for the guys that go on those Alaskan fishing boats. I mean, every lobbying group in the world has gotten some little exemption in there for them. I don't know what it might be for the truckers that are not involved in interstate commerce. Yes. All right. The question is, the base salary is $800 a week, and they get a production bonus of $200 a week. And this, there is a provision that says you can make up to 10%, which is $91.30 a week, of this $913 salary in production bonuses. I don't know why you'd ever do it, though, because once you get into the rules, you got to pay them the production bonus whether they meet it or not. And you have to do it on a quarterly basis. And there's all these restrictions on it. So it's like all you're really doing is holding their money back for a little bit of time. If you're using that, I mean, I've gone through this with several clients trying to figure out if we could, because a lot of people make a base salary and then incentive pay. And incentive pay is there to incentivize people. And so the Department of Labor wanted to say, oh, well, we're giving you this little incentive of 10%. But when you look at it, why would it be an incentive if I know I can't lose it? 10% is the max. Other questions? I know a lot about the restaurants in New Orleans, where to watch music, what drinks to avoid. If the drink's name is a weapon, don't go there. If it is a natural disaster, don't go there. Anyway, now again, thank you all for your time. Oh, wait, we've got another question here.
If we end up with a Republican president, is it likely that this will be overturned or is this
going to
hold?
If we end up with a Republican president, I think that it would be, I think that it would probably be modified. It will probably go down some. It's not going all the way back down to 455, though. I think everybody understands it. Look, it's been 455 for 20 years. It's time to raise that a little bit. It was just the amount that was so egregious, doubling the amount. All right, y'all take care. Thank you.
Thank you.